This morning we are very pleased to have with us Dr. David Tracy. He is from Yonkers, New York, and received his doctorate from Gregorian University in Rome in 1969. He served as instructor in theology at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. from 1967 to 1969, professor of theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School from 1969 to the present. He is professor in committee on the analysis of ideas and methods at the University of Chicago. He was named the Distinguished Service Professor in 1985 and named the Andrew Thomas Greeley and Grace McNichols, or Michaels Greeley, Distinguished Service Professor of Roman Catholic Studies in 1987. He is also the Professor in Committee on Social Thought. He spoke yesterday to the faculty and will speak today on the topic Naming God in the Contemporary World. We welcome to Concordia Seminary Dr. David Tracy.
Thank you, Dean Smith, and thank you all for the time I've had here, which has been wonderful, really. I had heard, of course, over many years of this great institution and tradition, but I had not known it was also so physically beautiful. It's an extraordinary place. And I thank you for letting me begin a little early because of the when planes are and when my seminar is back in Chicago this afternoon. I have to leave by 10 after. So we're beginning a little early. I'm thankful that you allow me to do that. Otherwise, I could not make my seminar and be even more guilt-ridden than I usually am. What I'd like to speak on this morning is to first sort of summarize it, and then I'll read it, that what I'm really concerned about in a book I've been trying to write for some years, and it will be two or three years more, is the relationship between form and content in from the Bible forward, including for the history of contemporary theology, especially since what I'm writing on is the doctrine of God for what I would call naming God and thinking God, and seeing how the forms are influential upon the content. Theologians and philosophers, in my opinion, including myself until maybe 10 years ago, have been relatively unconcerned with this, with, I think, unhappy results. Biblical scholars ordinarily are more concerned. I spoke in the faculty seminar of some of the results of this for the reading of the four Gospels and the different kinds of narratives in the four Gospels, and then Paul. And this morning I would like to speak on the naming of God in relationship to the contemporary setting, contemporary being a word that doesn't necessarily name the present, this curious moment which cannot name itself. Are we in late modernity or are we in post-modernity? And then there are many concerns to find the resources of the pre-modern periods. And it's this device that I'll try to use for sorting out some of these issues on the relationship in form and content for naming God in modernity, post-modernity, and pre-modernity. My basic thesis this morning is, I hope, a straightforward one, namely that any adequate naming and thinking God demands explicit attention to the complex hermeneutical issue of the elusive an intricate relationship between form and content in all theology. I have come to believe that only attention to the myriad forms of naming God, especially in the Bible and in the history of theology, could suffice for an adequate constructive theology today. But some further heuristic device would be needed, otherwise one would just begin to list all these namings and these forms, for trying at least to order some of the namings in the contemporary constructed theological project. One familiar tool to his historians of ideas, is ready to hand, I suggest, by use of the now familiar categories modern, pre-modern, and postmodern. Such categories, despite what is inevitably the essentially contested character of the exact meaning of each, even modernity, when did it begin, what are its characteristics, has it ended, is it ending, is there a post-modernity, allow for some chronological and even taxonomic clarity. Insofar as form does not just describe a meaning or content already there, but form, as modern hermeneutics tries to show, actually produces the meaning. These categories of modern, pre-modern, post-modern can allow some further hermeneutical clarification of some characteristic forms for naming and thereby thinking God that thinkers among us, theologians, moderns, pre-moderns, and post-moderns alike, may use. Since many of us, I suspect, tend in fact to be somewhat uneasy combinations of all three of these basic horizons of visions defining our contemporary moment, that is to say, there are aspects of each of us, in my opinion, likely, in myself, I would say, to be pre-modern, also modern, also in some post-modern. It becomes imperative to try to clarify the categories which may heuristically guide such a study. First, modernity. Beyond the debates on modernity and the character of rationality, or modernity and the nature of the subject, lies a further troubling dilemma on this question of form for naming and thinking God. Modernity, modern thought on the whole, lacked interest in, possibly even lacked intellectual respect for, many traditional forms for naming God as important for its own project. This lack of interest in form has in effect become a kind of unacknowledged part of the present melees of many modern theologies and philosophies. Modernity, in fact, did use and develop a characteristic form, in my judgment, for naming and understanding God. Indeed, modern thought believed that only its modern form could name and think God responsibly, that is to say, in keeping with modern reason. To produce that rational form, modern thinkers believed that all discourse should be decontextualized in order to constitute the preferred modern form for the issue of God, namely, what I would call a set of abstract propositions that have been arrived at through what will count as rational argument for a modern person. Only thus can a modern thinker claim to be able to abstract the essential attributes of God, and thus name and think God in properly modern terms. Except, and it is a great exception, in the case of perhaps the greatest modern of them all, Hegel, the moderns did not and do not argue for, as distinct from assume, their choice of this form of abstract proposition arrived through rational argument. Remember that Hegel's whole phenomenology can also be read as a problem of forms. What is the proper form for thought? So that his movement to the begriff, to concept, is an explicit move in relationship to the earlier forms of representation. That's why Hegel is so extraordinary still, I think. He's an exception, however, as a modern. Most moderns just, I think, instinctively move to concept, abstract proposition through rational argument on the issue of God. Insofar as this refusal to argue for a particular choice of form obtains, moderns, I believe, can be said to be unfaithful to their own insistence on the importance of arguing, not assuming, but arguing, on modern rational grounds for every central moment in their own inquiry. Hegel, almost alone among the great moderns, and there are a few more self-confident moderns than Hegel, saw both history and form, indeed the entire history of forms, as central to his own inquiry. This side of Hegel's thought, however, was and still is widely ignored by many, even Hegelians. What modernity provided, I think, for the naming of God on the question of form was a series of seemingly endless debates on what will count as the right ism, that is to say, the right set of correct abstract propositions for naming the nature and attributes of God on modern grounds. Moderns characteristically name God and think God in terms, I think, of some modern formulation of an ism. First modern ism, of course, the great modern ism first, was deism in the 17th and 18th centuries. Theism, as we speak of theism, is a modern formulation for naming and thinking God. The studies like Michael Buckley's very valuable studies, The Origins of Modern Atheism, can be summarized too simply, I admit, as the origin is modern theism. That is to say, when theologians began to formulate their principles in strictly philosophical modern terms, they formulated it as a theism rather than in relationship to the biblical traditions or the religious communities. Deism, theism, pantheism, one of the great modern isms, Spinoza and his influence, atheism in its modern forms. All of these existed in pre-modernity but have specifically modern forms. Agnosticism, perhaps the most frequent, and the peculiarly modern naming of God in theology, panentheism. The reign of these modernisms, each of them through a modern form of argument and through the modern form of a set of abstract propositions. What do you mean by deism or theism or pantheism or atheism or agnosticism or panentheism? Is secure. This is not just, I think, a thinker's problem. When empirical social scientific surveys like Gallup inform us, for example, that the United States is unusual among developed Western nations in that over 90% of the American public, when asked, say they believe in God, what exactly are they telling us? What ism applies? One can guess, for example, that a major candidate for many modern Western persons would be something like deism. A warmer deism, perhaps, than the 18th centuries, but deism nonetheless. Many of the official churches and synagogues continue to preach in their modern versions, a modern version of theism, whether it be what some would call classical theism or a more modernized form of theism. The official positions of the recently defunct communist parties, as well as many modern intellectuals of an older generation, preach, the verb is in fact accurate, modern atheism as the only rational option for a modern person. Many reflective intellectuals, both religious and secular, have become agnostic, which on the issue of naming, in its modern form, which on the issue of naming and thinking God, often serves as a kind of halfway house on the route to some form of postmodernity. Moreover, as the ecological spirit encompasses more and more, especially of young people, sensitive to the difficulties of the human relationship to nature and the wider cosmos, it is very clear that new, peculiarly modern forms of pantheism have returned to occur with something like new power, like the power they had in some forms of early modernity, like Spinoza and the conflict over Spinoza in German theology. Many other reflective persons, reigning recently from scientists, especially in cosmology and physics, through many theologians, in this country best known would be process theologians, but not only them, hold on to one or another version of the most original move, I think, modernity made for naming and thinking God on modern terms, with a modern form, the right ism, namely, what is now called panentheism. Hegel, for example, never used the word panentheism to describe his own understanding of God, but his position, finally, I think, is panentheist, not theist and not pantheist. And of course it is true that In the Anglo-American world, the process theologians, starting with Whitehead, have been the most articulate modern defenders of naming God in panentheist categories. Notice how they make their case, they try to make their case, including Hegel or process, not only in modern terms, but also in relationship to biblical namings. For example, the process claim is not only the claim that this is what modern persons can hold about God, but it is also the claim that this is how one can render conceptually coherent the central Christian naming of God, namely the great metaphor in 1 John 4:8, the Christian metaphor, God is love. The claim is that this can be rendered coherent by articulating it in these new panentheistic terms, because there one can articulate the intrinsically relational character of the divine reality, and even therefore allow for some understanding of the passion or suffering of God in accord with some modern sensibilities, as in Bonhoeffer's famous cry that only a suffering God can help. But what I would call, and try to analyze at length elsewhere, this conflict on the isms, what is the right ism for naming God, assumes that the only form is the form of what is the right set of abstract propositions arrived at through modern rational argument. Modernity has, in fact, a narrower notion of reason than pre-modern period. But there are two great alternatives to trying to name and think God in our contemporary period. Contemporary simply means you could be modern or pre-modern or post-modern. It doesn't name which of these is operative, or some combination thereof, which I think is the more likely case. These two attempts are attempts, I think, to think again some great unthought aspect of modernity's own self-understanding. Like I'm trying to question modernity's self-understanding about the relationship of form and content. There have, of course, been many critiques under rubrics of post-modernity about modernity's notion of rationality as much too narrow, or by recoveries of pre-modern resources of modernity's relative impoverishment on certain aspects of the Christian heritage, of the Jewish heritage, or even of the Greek heritage. Think, for example, even as early as the Romantics in the 19th century and the critique of the Enlightenment. From the early Romantics through the existentialists early in this century, through the new narrative theologies. Notice that's a recovery of a new form, narrative, for naming God, and a recovery of the biblical tradition of narrative. And it's a pre-modern resource in its biblical character. Both the analysis and the remedy of those who appeal to pre-modern resources have focused on the reality of form often, and the need to retrieve some pre-modern forms for naming and thinking God. What drives several new forms for thinking God in our pluralistic and ambiguous present is what drove many of the great romantics in the last century, a belief that modernity is over-dependent on a single form, the form of decontextualized abstract propositions articulated in accordance with the demands of modern rational argument. The kind of conceptual form produced by that kind of modern argument was the only form of reasoning that could be approved by modern thought, including in theology. Such an unthinking adherence to this form, it was feared by those who said, but the pre-moderns had resources that modernity has lost, have reinforced what the pre-moderns, starting with the romantics, would say is modernity's split between the classic ones for the romantic, freedom and nature, reason and feeling, desire and duty. What can be called now in retrospect an extraordinary explosion of forms, championed as early as Kant's third critique in his defense, his famous defense in the third critique, unthinkable in the first two critiques, of symbol and symbol's ability to think more than the concept could. It's a problem of form. Or the high romantic rediscovery of the fullness of symbol. That's what the romantics love, the full symbol. Found 100 new homes and thereby forms as the modern age began to waver in its initial self-confidence. Consider, for example, to mention too quickly, some familiar thinkers in the modern period who are troubled by this aspect of modernity. Those are the ones who interest me here. And try new forms. Schelling, in his later philosophy, his philosophy of myth, the form of myth. Coleridge, in the English-speaking world's reflection on the relationship of symbol. Kierkegaard's extraordinary thought experiments with different genres. There's no one like him. He will shift genres all the time, and by shifting genres, he knows he's shifting the content as well. That's why there's, I think, such a revival of interest in Kierkegaard. Or Nietzsche's thought experiments with style. He changes style as often as Kierkegaard changes genres. Or Tillich's theology of what he called how to reflect on living and dead symbols. Or Eliade's search for the Urform, like Goethe, who was his hero, of the dialectic of the sacred and profane amidst the history of the thousand forms in the morphology of the sacred in the different religions. Or I repeat, Hegel's confident early modern insistence that all symbolic forms are a stage on the route to the modern begriff or concept of the absolute, yielding now in the 20th century to someone, to, for example, Paul de Kure's great reversal of Hegel into a hermeneutics of the polyphonic forms of the absolute, so that Ricoeur will have to write a book on symbol, then a book on metaphor, then a book on narrative, the different forms demanded in all serious contemporary phenomenology and hermeneutics. All these trajectories in such different traditions of thinking and naming God, I believe, tell a single tale. Despite modernity's belief, there is no set of abstract propositions, no rational, clear, and distinct ideas, no sublating begriff, no rational doctrine, in a word, no adequate ism from deism forward, that is ever adequate for naming and thinking God. Each of them may, of course, have genuine insights. That's not the point, but it's not adequate. Modernity is always in danger of squandering the classical pre-modern heritage of the plural and possibly polyphonic forms for naming and thinking God, and thereby, for example, the many namings in the Bible, in favor of some singular meaning which, however valuable for its limited function, is nevertheless too narrow in its naming and too confined in its thinking to allow for the full range of pre-modern forms to find a new life. For example, the life of what Paul Ricoeur calls a second naivete for the once confident, now troubled modern thinker. In several Christian theologies of our period, for example, consider how prominent the question of form has become, even when not formulated as such. For example, the question of God can often be formulated now not so much as the nature and existence of God issues of modernity, but of the identity of God. Who is God? As God is rendered in and through the forms of God's own self-naming in the Bible. For the modern to think God, I repeat, is principally to try to find what on rational grounds one can say, what is the right abstract name, the right ism for affirming or denying on modern rational grounds the existence and nature of God. For those Christian theologians concerned to rediscover the full range of naming God in the scriptures, the question of God is not first the question of the existence and nature of God, though that's a legitimate question, but the question of God's identity. Who is God, as God has named God's self in and through all the forms of God's biblical names, including such a, in the history of Christian thought, summary, important summary form as Exodus 3:14 to the famous 1 John 4:8, God is love. And even though summary forms of naming can themselves be read as cryptic, which clarify but cannot replace the myriad namings of God in the great narratives, the prophetic texts, the hymnic and wisdom discourse, the legal, parabolic, and other forms of the scriptures. Consider, for example, the curious genre change which occurred almost despite themselves in two outstanding theologians of our contemporary period, who insisted that Christian theology must retrieve the too easily squandered pre-modern resources of the Christian tradition, Karl Barth and Hans Urs von Balthasar, both of whom were obsessed by form. Honor of time, I'll summarize those two, my comments on them, and move on to postmodernity. What is more and more intriguing, I think, about the revival of interest in Karl Barth, even for non-Barthians like myself, is that if you read the, one way of reading the dogmatics, as I mentioned yesterday, is to see how typical of a modern theologian he begins with the form of doctrine, which seems the relatively clearer form, and is a valuable form as such. But as the dogmatics moves forward, he becomes more and more interested in the great biblical narratives, and the dogmatics has a more narrative character to it. The new narrative theologies, especially at the Yale School but elsewhere, and their Barthian character, I think, is as much determined by Barth's recovery of the narrative form as history-like and realistic for the biblical form as it is by commitments to Barth's theology. Similarly, in the Roman Catholic instance, Karl Barth's great colleague and friend at Basel, Hans Urs von Balthasar, was performing a very similar enterprise in terms not of the narrative form, the history-like, realistic narrative form of the Bible, but rather of the forms in the liturgical and sacramental traditions. So that his whole multi-volume work on is as he calls the first volume, seeing the form. That the danger of Christianity is that it should not become formless, or it loses its incarnational character. Right? So he will try to recover aspects of the Christian tradition on form that were lost on the whole, or at least marginalized and should not be, like Pseudo-Dionysius, like Bonaventure, like Dante. And it's a very similar recovery of form. The point being that in contemporary theology, the appeal to pre-modern resources becomes even more intriguing, I think, when it is seen that part of what is occurring is the critique of modernity's over-dependence upon a single form and the need to recover the riches of the pre-modern forms, especially the biblical forms, which, if you think of it, has an extraordinary polyphony of forms in the Bible for naming and thinking God, and in the history of Christian reflection. I'm trying, for example, in the courses I'm doing now, the seminar I have to go back to this afternoon, to try to show how one of the things to watch is when a form drives almost to formlessness on inner Christian terms, the example being Meister Eckhart. What does it mean that a Christian says, I pray to God to free me from God, or start speaking of the Godhead beyond God, right? What's happening there? The easiest way to see it, I think, is watch what happens to the form. Similarly, I'm trying to, in the winter and spring, to return especially to Luther, the most extraordinary of all, on the hidden revealed God, especially hiddenness too, and what you might say the breaking of the forms, and the recovery both of the incomprehensible tradition, of the mystical traditions, and of the radical hidden revealed tradition in the contemporary scene, especially, as I'll now turn, by postmoderns, interestingly enough. So I'll now turn to them and conclude. Postmodern movements of thought, precisely as postmodern, have attempted to think some unthought aspect of modernity. By calling into question the very forms of modernity's own self-understanding, including what they would call the ontotheological form of modernity's naming of God, Many postmodern thinkers, secular and religious, have tried to initiate new ways, at once radically new and in many ways curiously ancient, for naming and thinking God. In the course of these new namings with new forms, postmodern thought has also cast doubt on any overconfidence in traditional pre-modern forms like narrative or symbol or drama. Von Balthasar's preferred form in the second part of his trilogy is drama, just as Barthes is narrative. A drama would be one that someone interested, especially in the liturgical, might turn to. As different as postmoderns are on the question of form from those thinkers I mentioned who appeal to pre-modern resources, like the new narrative theologies, they unite these postmoderns and pre-moderns in their critique of modernity, including their critique of modernity's narrowness on the question of form and therefore on content. You see, it isn't just, the point is, it can never be just form. In fact, a great deal of postmodern thought is directed towards exposing two illusions of modernity: the unreality of modernity's belief in its own in presence, its own self-present, the present, the modern, after all. The whole point of the debate on modernity, even from the beginning, is what are we so different, we moderns? Is the present so different from the past that it must have a new name? Now, obviously, no one in the 13th century went around saying we live in the medieval period, right? It's the moderns who named all those earlier periods. And it's the modern naming of itself as the present, which is also called into question by all these new reflections on presence and self-presence, as well as the debates on the modern understanding of purely autonomous self, which is certainly in deep trouble in most thought. In naming and thinking God, however, the postmoderns, what interests me as a theologian, is that the postmoderns, even the secular ones, like Derrida or Kristeva, retrieve, I think, two radicalized and largely marginal figures in the wider tradition, prophets and mystics. First, the mystics. In terms of approach to forms, postmoderns, I think, make two characteristic moves. They tend either to want to transgress the form, including, for example, the form of love, for God is love, beyond modern notions of love, which are usually, as in process theology or in Hegel, love, or in many new Trinitarian theologies, love as, like Pannenberg or Mauban or Lacuna, love is a relational reality. The point of God is love is to say God, in many, say, process or some forms of Trinitarian theology, is the relational character of the divine reality and the relational character of all reality. Right? That's a very modern move, in fact. The postmoderns or pre-modern on love, you could have, for example, the great Neoplatonic, where love is this overflow, this emanation, this gift that overflows, as in the famous image of the fountain, that the fountain which overflows and in the overflowing doesn't lose but simply gives. Right? Those two are valuable resources, those Neoplatonists, like in Bonaventure or Dante or somewhere. But postmoderns, I believe, they're also fascinated by love as the form for naming God. God is love. But they typically don't read it principally as relational or in, say, pre-modern Neoplatonic emanation terms. They read it as excess, even transgression. And that's why they're, I think, so interested in the love mystics, like Teresa of Avila, and this transgressive, excessive understanding of love. Postmoderns, as I read them, are also obsessed by form, but they tend to want form not to stabilize into, say, narrative or symbol or myth or drama or image, as the great retrievals of those forms are occurring now, postmoderns tend to be more interested in when form either transgresses itself, so that love will be read, as with, say, Teresa of Avila, as excess, or they will be interested in trying to drive form into a state of formlessness while still maintaining that it's Christian. Thus, the great interest in the apophatic mystical tradition. It's not so surprising that Derrida has been spending the last 2 years giving seminars on pseudo-Dionysius, right? Or that there's such a recovery of interest in figures like Nicholas of Cusa, or especially, of course, Eckhart. Because the question becomes, for these postmoderns, is it possible to have a position like Eckhart's and still be a Christian? Is that sort of movement to something like formlessness? I've been in the Buddhist Christian dialogue for about 7 years, and it's Buddhists who taught me to read Eckhart. Of course, Eckhart is the favorite theologian, Western theologian of Buddhists, understandably, because it's the movement to formlessness, right? Just as so many postmodern secular thinkers are also so interested in Buddhism. Because of this interest in watch what happens to the form, either driven to excess or transgression, or, as in love mysticism, or driven like apophatic mysticism to something like formlessness. Well, I'll leave out the rest on that and then turn to the prophets in the new period. In many ways, many of the new prophetic theologies are also recognizably postmodern rather than modern or pre-modern in their naming and understanding of God. Like the great earlier neo-reform theologies of our century, many contemporary liberation, political, and some feminist theologies usually find the understanding of the hidden and revealed God of Luther and Calvin and Pascal more appropriate to their understanding of God as postmoderns than they do the mystical, incomprehensible God tradition like Eckhart. Unlike the early neo-orthodox theologies, at least those in their existentialist mode, like, say, Bultmann or Tillich, these new theologies are less likely to find the revelation of God's hiddenness in the experience of cross as the estrangement, when it's translated into existentialism, not Luther, in other words, as the estrangement of the famous alienated self of modernity. These great existentialist theologies could really make a very appealing case to the alienated sense of self of that period in modernity. That's why Tillich could call existentialism the good luck of Christian theology, because for him it expresses the same anthropology as the Christian already believes about the dilemma of the self always turning in upon itself, and the simul justus et peccator, of the self become the alienated, estranged, sinful self of modernity. But now, the cross is newly read in these new prophetic theologies, I think, as the revelation of God in weakness, in vulnerability, in conflict, in suffering, to be sure, but not so much the suffering of the alienated self of modernity, but the suffering of the concrete reality of those whole groups that have been in effect designated non-persons by the dominant culture, including dominant modern culture, modernity's own self-image. We are the moderns. We are the wave of history. The oppressed and the marginalized in all history. The categories are familiar categories to postmodern thought employed in many of these theologies. Otherness, difference, marginality. The obsession with the question of the other, the different, the marginal, is characteristic of almost any form of postmodern thought, I would say. Because the claim is, of course, that modernity made everything the same. and everyone had to be the same, and so that anything other and different was finally insignificant, including other cultures, because modern Western culture is culture. And other cultures are either going to catch up to or find themselves left behind by this self-confident culture. And it is not surprising that in both philosophy and theology, such a principal category becomes otherness, difference, even marginality. Like the earlier biblical theologies of, say, the 1950s, wonderful ones, these new theologies of God as a God who acts in history are likely to turn the biblical narrative accounts of God's actions as the signal clues even now for God's self-disclosure and thereby God's reality. The whole narrative of Exodus will now provide the clue to how to read Exodus 3:14. Unlike earlier biblical theologies, God's actions are here more typically to be found in the reality of God's self-disclosure in the cross now of God, of the other, of the different, of God's preferred ones to the prophets, the oppressed and marginalized of history. For history is again the locus of God's actions, unlike the mystics. This will mean neither what will now be read as Metz's critique of the homogeneous evolutionary understanding of time and of modernity of the great liberal and modern theologies of historical consciousness, like Trelch, nor the historicity of the solitary individual of existentialist and transcendental theologies, like Bultmann or Rahner. Rather, history will now be read, notice, in these theologies as the focus of God's self-disclosure in cross, in the survival, struggle, conflict of oppressed and forgotten peoples, living and dead. It's crucial on the Christian, as Metz and Moltmann correctly insist, to keep insisting, and the dead. In otherness, difference, marginality, the struggle for liberation of Exodus becomes the secret to God's self-naming, even in Exodus 3:14, something never occurred to Thomas Aquinas, as the promising, faithful, liberating God. My point is, through these very brief remarks, that the question of form and the relationship of form and content, I think, has returned in our period to complicate, perhaps forever, all theological thought on God. The great recovery of pre-modern forms, like the recovery of narrative or symbol or drama or metaphor or image, and the strange combination that one can find in some postmoderns on form of excess and detachment, of excess and formlessness, as well as the recovery of the form of history not as fundamentally continuous as for the moderns, but as interruptive, and therefore a recovery, notice, of the form of apocalyptic, read as an interruption of history, a disruption by the suffering and conflicts of the forgotten ones of history. And of course, the famous word is that the victors write the histories and write them as continuous narratives, including modernity. But what about if history is read from the underside? History becomes disruptive, conflictive, cross. Remember, even Hegel had this sense with his famous claim that history is a slaughter bench, but reason will take over. It's that second point that the postmoderns do not share with Hegel. They do not have that modern confidence, and that turns everything around, including this search for a new form, like apocalyptic. As I mentioned yesterday, when you ask a theologian, political theologian like Metz, give me one word for what religion is, Metz's choice is interesting: interruption. Interruption of the same, of the continuous, of one's present self-understanding, of complacency. The great isms of what now seem the classic tradition of modernity remain to focus our attention with their clarity and sharpness, but that clarity, I suggest, must now also yield its dominance by questioning, letting go, of its single form for the many forms of naming and thinking God. In that context, that pluralistic context, affirming genuine otherness and difference, not merely modern tolerance or pre-modern exclusivity, the classical naming of God as love returns to haunt the contemporary theological imagination. But now it haunts with the entire history of reception, the entire history of forms that become clearer and clearer into view for anyone who will take seriously the resources now available in the pre-modern, the modern, and even the post-modern periods. Thank you.